have police photographing our license plates.
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to The Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Hello, this is Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, welcoming you to The Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio, where my guest today, Sue Friedman, is the CEO and president of the Alzheimer's Association in Central and Western Virginia. Welcome, Sue. How are you this day?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm terrific. I do always look forward to our conversations, as Sue knows so much about dementia and Alzheimer's and all the latest research, and you even have a training program now, yes, Sue, to help, I presume, caregivers?
We do. There's a number of things. We have the foundations and the basics, which are training programs that we can provide to professional caregivers. Online, though, we now have a program called CARES. It's an online dementia certification program that's available for any caregiver, whether it be a family member, a friend, or a professional caregiver. So we've got that great opportunity for people to receive a certification. And then we have a third area of what I would call training and education, and that's our educational programs that we do. We've got a great new series called Living with Alzheimer's, so it's really geared towards caregivers and family members.
Mm-hmm.
And a brand new program called Conversations About Dementia. And it really tries to give people, if you will, tools and guidelines and tips for how they can engage in these conversations about dementia and Alzheimer's with friends and family, and certainly with the individual that they feel either is or might be personally affected by Alzheimer's.
Mm. Well, every conversation with you is an education and a training. So we're not leaving that thought, but thinking about preventive or at least slowing down. I know there's no magic bullet to cure Alzheimer's. You've told us that before. But we can sort of slow down the process by teaching the brain to learn new things. Is that?
Well, one of the things research is helping us understand, we cannot stop Alzheimer's. We can't avoid it, but we can delay the negative impacts that one feels from Alzheimer's by doing several, if you will, lifestyle things. And the one thing that is proven by research to help delay Alzheimer's is exercise. So I say to every group that invites me to speak, if you don't exercise, start today.
Yes.
Talk with your doctor and do what's appropriate for you. But 3 40-minute exercise sessions a week has been proven through research to delay the onset, if you will, of the negative impacts of Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
So exercise, exercise, exercise.
Yes.
But you mentioned learning new things, and that there's very strong evidence. Now, we can't say it's proven, but there's very strong research evidence that the more we learn and continue to learn, the better our brains can, if you will, compensate for any new effects that Alzheimer's may have. And this is called cognitive reserve. It's a fascinating term. And as Dr. Carol Manning, who is a neurologist and runs the memory clinic at the University of Virginia, explains it, your brain has greater workarounds. your brain has greater capacity to kind of, if, you know, work around, over, and under in a memory roadblock. Because that cognitive reserve has, if you will, strengthened and enhanced the brain. In the brain world, they call it plasticity. It has provided more pathways for the brain to reach that decision or that memory that you want it to reach, and therefore can overcome what may be the beginning impacts of Alzheimer's.
That's fascinating and so helpful. But how does, you know, the average person recognize warning signs? You say there are 10 warning signs?
There are 10 warning signs, and I highly recommend people visit our website, which is ALZ, just the first three letters in the long word of Alzheimer's, ALZ.org, and the 10 warning signs are there prominently. And of course, the few that I would point out of the 10, we all know about memory. It's not so much fact memory as it is what I call functional memory, not remembering that aluminum foil doesn't go in the microwave. Not remembering that a gallon of milk goes in the refrigerator and instead you see it in the pantry.
Gotcha.
So not remembering how things work and what they're for is a sign. And so we want to be mindful of that. The other things that we're very mindful of are cooking and baking.
Yes.
Someone who's, I know my mother makes a fantastic creme de mint cake.
Oh, wow.
And if she said to me, you know, I'm 84 years old and I'm tired of making that cake every Thanksgiving, I'm not making it this year. I understand that.
Yes.
But I would say to her, well, let's get out the recipe and explain it to me and I'll try to make it. If she can't explain the recipe to me, that's something we want to be concerned about, because what that means is the C period and the one half and the et cetera in a recipe no longer makes sense to her brain.
Are you also saying that maybe trying to avoid doing something you've done always is also a sign?
Yes, it most definitely is. And it may well be that your 84 years of doing that or 70 years is plenty. But, you know, we want to be inquisitive and try to make sure that this isn't just an avoidance. And so there's a third area where you're exactly right, that kind of avoidance comes in. If my mother, and I will use her example because she's in Indiana and she doesn't know I'm talking about her, she wouldn't mind though. But if she said, I'm not going to the family reunion this year, or I'm done with church, I'm not going to church every Sunday. But those are things that were very important to her and she had religiously done those.
Yes.
Then I would want to maybe gently inquire about, well, you know, I know it's a big crowd at church, and sometimes it's hard to hear the minister or whatever, because the third area that we know is impacted by Alzheimer's is what we call executive function. And my best example of that is in a crowd, anywhere someone listening today, anywhere you are later today, whether it's the store or a restaurant or a party, your brain automatically let you zero in on the conversation you're having.
Yes.
And your brain doesn't allow you to hear the 15 other conversations going on. And so your brain is calm and quiet and it is able to focus. Well, executive function is taken away early into Alzheimer's disease, so that that restaurant or that party or that shopping trip feels like mass chaos to the brain. They're hearing 15 conversations in their brain, and they cannot process it. It's just very anxiety provoking. It can lead to some of those negative behaviors we hear about from families. But what it ultimately leads to is the person saying, I'm not going anymore. And they withdraw and they become a little isolated. So again, it may well be that my mother is just sick and tired of being around people.
Yes, yes.
then that's her choice.
Yes.
But I'm going to ask a few questions and kind of watch her behavior a little to just to make sure that whether she realizes it or not, her brain is letting her down.
Yes. You know, a slight shift. I don't want to, you know, we have so much to talk about. And of course, the warning signs and how diagnosis, etc., are all important. It's just as I listen to you, Sue, you know, from our past conversations, you remind me of so many things I have experienced with my parents.
And I think it's important that you share those.
Well, I was just wondering, because this one never occurred to me, and I do think it was unrelated, and I hope you can reassure me. Of course, both parents are gone now, but my parents were in church every day.
Yeah.
And I was living in New York or whatever. But then there came a point where they weren't attending church. And this was long before any noticeable mental change, at least noticeable to me. And long before, you know, I got the call, I think I've told you before, an aunt said the bank had called because Dad hadn't paid for the car. Well, my father was never late in payments of anything. So that made me come back to their home and find out. And that clearly there was a difference in them, even though at
right.
the time I certainly was no expert. But I asked them questions, and it was the last conversation. My dad simply said, my mom looked at him. That's why I don't think it was about Alzheimer's at that point, but I don't know after hearing what you've said. But I asked why they stopped going to church, because I'd never known them not to go to church. I'd complained all my youth about being dragged off to church. And mom looked at Dad, you know, of course, she wasn't going to say anything unless he said something. And then his response was, well, they're just different kind of people there now. When I realized what was happening to my parents, I started on occasion inviting relatives to celebrate things like their anniversary or their birthday, because we want to do this while they still remember. And in our case, it did spark some things, especially in Mom. I used to take them out to breakfast and da-da-da. That was a Sunday routine, and I tried to continue that as long as that was possible. But on this particular day, Mom was always a backseat driver, and of course, I had lived long enough to regret that she couldn't be anymore. It was so sad not to hear her telling me how to drive. But this particular day, when I had invited the family in from all over and said, you need to come because I don't know how much longer they will know who you are, and people did. They came from everywhere. But I decided to take Mom out to breakfast that morning. And I did, and we were driving and on the Washington Beltway, and a car was entering, and Mom said, watch that car. Now, you have to understand, this was, as I'm sure you do, but those listening, that was the first complete sentence pointed a direction that I had heard from my mother in at least a year. We'd get phrases, we'd get, you know, colors, one word. She loved a blue shirt that I got as many of the same color because she'd call it ocean, you know. But in any case, we had her back for the entire day. When people walked in we hadn't seen, even people, relatives I didn't know, because of course the word was spread, Mom would get up out of her seat and welcome them in, hi, and it's been so long. And everyone thought I was nuts, because here they'd rushed in from everywhere thinking she wouldn't know anyone, and she knew everyone.
These were people from her past.
Yes. And that's the long past, exactly.
Yes.
Now, Dad, on the other hand, and sat in that crowd like what you were describing, clearly not knowing where he was, who these people were, and very uncomfortable, but hiding it from, I knew only because I was watching him, and by this time I had learned some things about what was going on. But he wouldn't communicate at all. And then in the last 20 minutes, I watched it happen, in the last 20 minutes of the time that they were supposed to be there, the guests, Dad suddenly, boom, popped up, looked around, and started going around the room. Hello, how are you? What are you doing? And he had just arrived. He only stayed for 20 minutes, that is mentally, but he was there. What, when we talk about caregivers and family, how do you deal with the return and then the loss again?
That up and down, you know, Alzheimer's is a progressively downhill battle, but it's up and down, going downhill. And what we help families think about is, how can you each minute of each day be with your loved one where they are?
Yes.
And they may be last year, they may be today for 10 minutes.
Yes.
And maybe 40 years ago. So I think you shared a fabulous example of how you created an atmosphere that was where your parents were.
Yes, even though
and
they weren't.
Or they could be present, even though it was in their past.
Yes.
They could be present today in their past.
Well, was that, and I'm not searching for compliments, I'm searching for the answers for the audience. Was that a smart thing to do? I mean,
yeah, we know that pictures and picture albums,
yes,
music, events and activities, trips from progressively back in their past are things that can be connected.
Yes.
You know, as the disease goes through the brain, it starts with short term, it starts with judgment, executive function, it starts there, and it slowly marches to the past. It's, in other words, you've heard this called the journey backwards.
Yes, yes.
You just take the journey backwards. But I do want to look at the glass as a little half full, because we know two things now that remain deep into the disease and therefore have the capacity to be connectors. One is everything about the arts, whether it's their college alma mater song, or Frank Sinatra, or a picture, everything about the arts appreciation and connecting remains late into the disease. So we now have a huge creative arts program specifically designed for people with Alzheimer's and dementia and their caregivers.
Wow. I know that's true, because I think a doctor told me that, and I got these CDs of old radio comedies, and when I played that, they would laugh. Dad would slap his knee. Mom would cry tears laughing, and it was just so amazing. But when the CD stopped, that was that.
That connection was lost, if you will.
Yeah.
It's almost, if you think of electricity, when you plug it in, you get electricity. When you unplug it, you don't.
Yes.
The second area that we know remains deep into the disease, even very late stages when there's no communication at all, is feelings.
Yes, yes.
People know if they're safe. They know if they're cared about.
Yes.
They can still connect with those feelings. As someone said to me, my mother has no idea who I am, but she thinks I'm a nice woman.
Yes, yes.
And so we help families, rather than look at the deficits, this is what we say in our world, look at the abilities.
Excellent. Well, that is a wonderful place, I think, to stop for a moment and take a break. Everyone, stay with us. I am talking to and listening to Sue Friedman, who is the president and CEO of the Alzheimer's Association in Central and Western Virginia. Again, that website, alz.org. And we will be right back in just a moment. Please stay with us.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute, where the artist wowed us and even won an Oscar for Best Picture. Blanca Nieves is a more worthy reminder of the unique art that ran rampant within the best of silent films. Wonderfully, this retelling of the Snow White fairy tale is not simply a children's bedtime story. True to the original Brothers Grimm, there is no sugarcoating of the evil at work. In this Spanish retelling, Antonio is a star bullfighter who has a very bad day. Showing off for the crowds and his pregnant wife, Antonio is gored savagely, leaving him a quadriplegic. While in surgery, his wife goes into labor, passing away during the delivery of their daughter, Carmen. In mourning over his condition and the loss of his beloved, Antonio shuns his daughter and succumbs to an evil temptress who absorbs his wealth and locks him away in the darkness. And what of Carmen? She is saved from evil by a troop of traveling bullfighting dwarfs who name her Blancanieves, Snow White in Spanish. But you know the story. Though the originality in this retelling is delightful, extra power resides in its reminder of the uniqueness of the silent acting form and in the beauty inherent in rich black and white imagery. Both a sight to behold. Blancanieves, not in theaters, discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. My guest today, Sue Friedman, who is the president and CEO of the Alzheimer's Association in Central and Western Virginia. Let's talk about some of the reasons family members need to have a power of attorney, like life insurance,
well,
bank accounts, etc.
It's a great tip for families, and it's a power of attorney, but there are multiple ways to have power of attorney, and I'm not an attorney, but we work with a lot of elder law attorneys. There's power of attorney for financial things, there's power of attorney for legal issues, there's medical directives, which is a form of a power of attorney. So it's what's critical about this is at the point the disease renders someone no longer legally competent,
yes,
then they cannot transact their legal and financial business. And if we haven't taken care of providing these very valuable documents, then you can't either. The loved one can't either. And so what happens? Well, we end up in court, or we end up in a family battle.
Yes.
And those are two areas that we know we don't need to go.
Exactly.
And so it's critically important that families take advantage of this. And what we did in my family, and I don't have anyone with Alzheimer's, and I certainly don't have Alzheimer's myself, but in doing our will and our, quote, estate planning, the elder law attorney said, and here are six other documents that would complete your total planning. So if we can help families see these, quote, other documents as part of doing the will.
Yes.
And preparing for your transfer of estate the way you want. Because otherwise, the number one issue for elder abuse in Virginia is not physical abuse. It is financial abuse.
Yes.
And so we don't want our loved one to be vulnerable to others, but we don't want our loved one to be vulnerable to themselves. And I'll tell you a very short story. At our Culpeper event recently, a neurologist spoke publicly about his challenges with his mother, who convinced her attorney that he was out to do harm to her.
Yes.
So got his name taken off of every document, and she proceeded to go out and open 16 different bank accounts.
Oh, my goodness.
So by the time the lawyers helped the siblings, the children, undo that, a lot of money and time was spent, unfortunately.
Yes.
So it's really important that families have these conversations. And on our website, we actually have scripts. We actually have videos about how to have this conversation, how to do it in a non-threatening way, how to do it in a collaborative, loving way.
Yes.
There's a particularly moving and effective video, a woman having a conversation with her husband. I'm going to suggest they're in their 70s or 80s. In an attempt to take away the car keys.
Yes.
And she starts by saying, you've always been such a good husband.
Yes.
And such a good provider. And I know and feel your love. We all do in the family. And we know you want all of us to be safe and happy. And by golly, at the end of this video, he hands her the keys.
Yeah.
Because she's done it in a way that doesn't make him feel penalized.
Exactly.
She's done it in a way of we together, all of us, want to make the very best of this.
And you know, I had to go through that with Dad. I mentioned Dad a lot because it seemed to be He fought it more than mom, I guess, is the thing.
Dependence is a four-letter word for a lot of people.
Exactly.
It is.
But we actually, Dan and I, had at least three different conversations, very calm, about his driving, just because when I followed him one day in my car to check on where he was, because by that time I knew things were happening, and when I saw some things, I started that conversation. It wasn't to force or to push, or certainly not to insult, and you know, all the things you've said, but we did. And one conversation would end, yes, you're right, and then when it was time to do it, the conversation was very different, and I didn't start a fight. Well, finally, about the fourth time the subject came up, I said, you know, Dad at that point still had the old pickup truck that he loved to drive around, and I said, you know what, let's go for a ride. And I drove through the neighborhood, only two or three blocks, turned a couple of times, and then I asked Dad, would you like to drive home? And he said, yes. And I know when I say it, I feel like, gee, how it was such a sneaky thing to do.
Yeah.
But he drove to the top of the hill, and we could see the house, and he didn't know where to go. And he turned to me, and he said, you're right. And I told him where the house was, and he drove home. And when we got there, he gave me the keys. So I guess it's not easy. It's not pleasant.
No. And I'll tell you, some families, it's in the world of being where someone is, there may not be facts. There may not be truth.
Yes.
There may be a lot of gray.
Yes.
And so we've had families who let the keys stay and let the driver's license stay. They just disabled the car. So there's all
these
ways. Because if someone really identifies and feels that they are known as someone who drives, you don't want to take that away.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so let them keep the keys, let them keep the driver's license, but just make sure that the car can't go anywhere.
Yes. That's very good.
So there's a lot of different strategies for that. I know one family came in to us and said every night mom asks to see dad.
Mm.
And dad has been dead for 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
So every night we have to tell her that dad's dead. And our recommendation, knowing how this disease works, is no, you don't.
Yes,
you
exactly.
You can say, look at the time. It's a little late tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll see about tomorrow. Because in essence, what the family of well-meaning,
mm-hmm.
out of love, what they were doing, though, is encouraging their loved one, their mom, to experience that guilt, grief,
yes.
for the first time.
Every time.
Every night.
Yes.
And there's no need.
No.
There's really no need for them to understand the truth.
So that brings us to redirection, which I guess is what you're describing. Tell us about redirection.
Well, redirection, it's got many moving parts, but in one part it is simply to, like this example, say, maybe tomorrow, so later,
mm-hmm.
we can come and address this. But another one would be to say, mom, tell me one of your best memories of you and dad's vacation, or a family event, or in other words, engage. Obviously mom is thinking about her husband.
Yes.
And with good feelings.
Yes.
And so let's go with those good feelings, and let's go with that thought, and let's engage her. Bring out the picture book. Bring out the wedding picture.
Yes.
And start, you know, a redirection into a happy conversation.
Yes.
So there's many ways to do redirection. There's, if grandchildren are around, say, mom, you know, Joey would like to show you his schoolwork.
Yes.
You know, so you don't want to be negative. give, and you don't want to create undue anxiety. You want to try to gauge where your loved one is in their cognitive abilities.
Yes.
And be there with them. Join them there.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I had to say to family and a number of caregivers, we ultimately ended up the last few years with a live-in, several people for mom and dad. But I should throw in, as I'm sure you would agree, if possible, keeping the surroundings that they're used to helps. And I was able to do that. Not everyone can, and so no one should feel guilty about that. But I was able to keep my parents in their home and bring the caregivers to live there. But I just a quick little moment about dad had died, and by that time I had put them beside one another in these two different comfortable chairs so they could do whatever together and reach one another. There came a point where letting dad be able to reach mom wasn't always safe, so we just moved the chairs a little further apart, but it worked. And then one memory I always will have is that, for at least a month after dad had died, when the caregivers would bring mom out of the bedroom and into the living room and get her all set up after breakfast and whatever, she would peer around the caregiver looking at the empty chair. And she did that for at least a month. She never asked, but she would look to see. And, you know, anyway, life insurance.
That feeling, and, you know, her brain couldn't go all the way to know that maybe she was looking for your father.
Yes, yes.
But the feeling of comfort and safety and love was associated with that chair.
Yes. Because even at his worst, on his worst days, dad would occasionally, especially if we had a guest come by from church or family, he would say, "This is my wife." I mean, out of nowhere, "This is my wife." You know, they're great moments. I will say, so that everyone can learn from my mistakes anyway, one thing that did not occur to me was life insurance. They had had life insurance all their lives. I knew about it. I knew I was the beneficiary. But it just didn't occur to me until we'd reached a point where, when it did occur to me, they were unable to tell me anything. I went through past checkbooks to look for it, but it just never happened. So tell, what other things might we miss in the throes of this?
Well, pensions and things like that, from long ago. I'll tell you, and this is just I think all of us, I've created a document called the Friedman Family Business.
Very good.
And it's a print document. It's also electronic, but it lists everything anybody would need to know and go look for.
Excellent.
I say what it is, and I say what box or cabinet or drawer they can find it in. So that's a good resource.
Yes.
And, you know, that's a project we could all do now with our parents who are getting older. You know, show me where the file cabinet is. Do you have a list in there? If you don't want to give it to me, make sure I know where it is, that the list is complete.
Yes.
And, you're exactly right.
Well, I guess that brings us to the stress level for caregivers. This is something that is a family situation. Yeah. It's not just the patient, but talk to us, Sue.
Well, this is a disease that as it progresses for the person who is stricken with it, it gets harder for the caregiver.
Yes.
Because as you lose your connection to the world and to your memory, you lose the capacity to be upset or that concern, because you're not aware of what you're missing.
Yes.
So then the burden becomes quite hard for the caregiver. It's a physical burden. It's not easy to take care of someone's physical needs and getting them up and down and making sure they eat. But it's a very, very detrimental emotional and psychological burden.
Yeah.
So we have over 40 support groups here at the association, and they are well attended, and people find them very, very helpful, because you can walk into that room and never explain a thing. Yeah. Everybody knows.
Yes.
And then we have an 800 number. I always like to make sure people know that any minute of any day or night, you can call 800-272-3900 and talk to one of our professionals. I know I had one family say, I called Saturday night at 11:30 because I could not get him to go to sleep, and I was just exhausted.
Yes.
And I needed help right then. She said, and I got help. She
Excellent.
Said, we worked out a strategy, and that way we both got a good night's sleep, and I was refreshed for the caregiving in the morning. But caregivers, number one, you must recognize
yes.
that there is greater stress with Alzheimer's than nearly any other disease.
I agree, and to tag on to that, please, something you have said to me before, it is not like having children.
No, if children learn that the oven is hot.
Yes.
Children learn that cars go up and down the street. People with Alzheimer's do not learn that, and they will not learn that. Mm. And it doesn't matter if you're unhappy with them or if you're guilty or resentful, they're not going to learn it.
Exactly.
And so we as caregivers have to find ways to understand, number one, it's the disease that says those nasty things.
Yes. Yes.
And number two, that the best we can do is provide the care we can provide, and when we can't provide it,
yes,
or not emotionally able to accept and ask for help.
Yes.
I mean, the guilt has got to be thrown out the window.
Yes.
It just is damaging. As one gentleman told me, he said, I don't think God intended for two people to die from Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's very real that that caregiver stress, if we allow its impact to continue, will cause physical and emotional problems for the caregiver.
Yes. It was a challenging time, and I am so happy that even though I'm learning about you and this only since I've been in Virginia, but everyone who listens and participate in the walk to end Alzheimer's and donate through awareness and donate funds, this couldn't be more important because we either get older or we don't. And if we get older, the chances, what are the numbers, the percentages again, Sue, about?
Well, at age 65, it's 1 in 8. At age 85, it's 40 to 50%.
Wow. So,
yes. And the other thing that we're saying, obviously, this is predominantly a disease of the aging brain.
Yes.
But here's something to think about for all of our listeners and viewers. Everyone with the brain is at risk of Alzheimer's. So everyone, we believe, everyone has a reason to want Alzheimer's to end.
Absolutely.
So take advantage of our programs and services. Make sure you know the warning signs. And for goodness sakes, join us.
Yes.
Join this fight.
And again, that website is alz.org. And we've been talking to Sue Friedman, the president and CEO of the Alzheimer's Association in Central and Western Virginia. Sue, it has, as always, been incredibly enlightening and helpful and inspiring and also uplifting, because you can look at this and be afraid, or you can look at this and go, you know, this is possible for everyone. Let's start making those lists. Let's start letting ourselves know, as not just for our parents, that's important, but for ourselves as well. This is where things are. Let's know about life insurance and bank accounts, and let's know, as you have said this morning, and I often said to family and caregivers, it's not them talking, it's the disease. You have to be where they are now, but you have to love what they have always been and not just a disease.
Exactly.
Thank
well
you.
Said it. Well, and I want to say thank you for being part of this fight and giving us this great opportunity to join you. It really makes a difference in helping people become aware. So thank you for being a champion of the cause.
Thank you, Sue. Take care and best of all you're doing. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Stay with us as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. In recommending this film, a friend called it one of the films he respected most yet never wanted to see again.
Requiem for a Dream is an early work of writer-director Darren Aronofsky, who went on to create other admirable films, including The Wrestler and Black Swan. This is a cautionary tale, sharing parallel stories on the dangers of addiction. For one generation, drugs are prescribed to provide easy answers to life's challenges. For another, recreation and escape. For both, addiction leads to a harrowing place no human would ever choose to go. Mr. Aronofsky is an uncompromising director. When the ratings board felt that his film should be assigned its strongest restriction, it suggested the need to change the nature of certain very powerful scenes. In full knowledge of the likely cost to the film and his career, Darren refused to change his vision and released the film without a rating. As most theaters will not play unrated films, this eliminated any possibility of widespread viewership and resulted predictably in relative obscurity for the film. Requiem for a Dream is uncompromising cinema that is worthy of being seen, but probably only once. Indie Film Minute, not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard around the world. Beheading, voter ID, and Ebola panic. Americans are often charged with, accused of, and even begged to be both first in war and first in peace. But first in panic? For any American hospital to release a patient with 103 temperature, regardless of his travel itinerary, offends the Hippocratic oath to first do no harm. For health officials, trapping his family in squalor of infectious materials, inhumane. And failing to protect their healthcare staff, prophetic? We are what we complacently allow corporate America and governments to finance for power while we wink and nod to a device. We're either with a 60-year-old Indian Hindu human rights activist for children or silent partner to jeering condemnation for a Lower Manhattan Islamic Community Center. We either embrace education equality like a 17-year-old Islamic Pakistani girl, or we inflict children crawling through Texas border mud to ask the Statue of Liberty to keep her word with mob rule. We either drool over having a police state with the power to snatch life and water from minorities, or we rise up and walk hands and heads held high in peaceful protest heard round the world. We can have faith in karmic raises, or we can demand equal pay for women and a $10.10 minimum wage. When did we become so pessimistic that we can't stand up to corporatism's supreme damnation while moving forward to the horizons of science, math, and creative artists that reveal the way, the truth, and the light of verifiable facts? Like Kansas Republicans against cokehead Sam Brownback, Kentucky coal miners need to know their enemy. It's not a corporate compromised EPA, nor a president preaching the myth of clean coal, but coal companies like Murray Energy that have deserted mining families for greener pastures. Either we can distinguish between the Americanized fiction of Argo and the filmic genius of Lincoln, or be seduced by Bill Maher's irrelevance, except for new rules, and succumb to the motherlode of Sam Harris's bad ideas. Either way, polls dupe us with the meaningless question, is the country headed in the right direction? As did an October NPR call-in insisting panel use Democrat, not Democratic, because we are a democracy. Truth is, we are a republic because our founding fathers feared the judgment of misinformed mobs. There are only two directional choices for America: forward, or the hellish reversal of fortune of pro-lifer Todd Kincannon shooting those who might have Ebola. Why stop at Ebola symptoms? Why not those who protest rigged voting machines, or all those people who resemble Obama more than our $20 bill memorialized Indian killer? Even after Michael Brown lay dead on a Ferguson street in a Darren Wilson-produced pool of blood, Thomas Thomas Eric Duncan was ignored to death, in part because Koch-financed conservatives like Rick Perry have neither the intellectual wherewithal nor humanity to allow American citizens the benefits of affordable health care. Panic blinds us to private prison profiteering, fixed voting machines, corporatism increasing and multiplying through war, marching us backwards into Koch-disguised Jim Crow, trial by militarized police, while giving enterovirus D68 and flu the edge. We can recognize the true descendants of America's original Minutemen militia are our National and Coast Guards, or we can disfigure the Second Amendment, distort freedom of speech into Wall Street cash, and defile the American voting privilege, even to former felons, with targeted voter ID laws. As the Secret Service is charged with protecting our president, we the people are charged with protecting America by voting, even if needing CDC to soothe the savage breast with a superficial show of another airport layer of protection. Why panic? Can we not still slay dragons of ignorance, fearful greed, dereliction complacency, hateful pride, self-righteous arrogance, racial discrimination, same-sex marriage bans, and yes, even Citizens United elections? As religion is overused excuse for war, rape, and murder, loving God and country is insufficient without loving thy neighbor as thyself. Voting and helping seniors and first-timers to do so is America's best direction. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of thereasonablevoice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.